Next case up is United States versus Lantis, docket 20-8031. Mr. Smith, when you're ready to go, please proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Grant Smith with the Federal Public Defenders, and I represent Mark Lantis. We agree that the magistrate judge correctly cited the applicable recklessness standard. The error here is that there's sufficient record evidence to indicate that the magistrate did not go on to correctly apply that standard.
I thought you made it clear that you were not making a sufficiency of the evidence argument.
We aren't making a sufficiency of the evidence argument.
I thought that's what you just said. So
no, our argument is solely that the magistrate misapplied the applicable standard. And there's three pieces.
You're saying you use the phrase, there's sufficient evidence to say that he misapplied the standard, which is a little confusing, but I think
I understand the confusion. And I mean record evidence. Looking at the record in this case, this court has reason to believe that the correct standard was misapplied. And the first indication that the magistrate misapplied the correct standard is the magistrate's silence in its analysis, its written analysis, determining and detailing that Mr. Lantis was guilty of the charged crime. The parties agree that in order to be guilty, Mr. Lantis had to be subjectively aware of the risk and consciously disregard that risk. However, nowhere in the court's written order and its analysis does it ever mention Mr. Lantis's subjective state of mind when he decided to go off trail and take what he thought was an easier route back to the road.
But this is a very odd posture, isn't it? You're conceding that there was substantial evidence. I don't know where that's coming from, but perhaps someone could.
It's not here.
Christine, do you need to go, Christine?
I'm going to see if this is a drill, but there's a fire alarm that apparently just went off in the U.S. Attorney's Office building, the Dick Cheney building here in Casper.
Let's stop the clock.
Let's take a break.
But what we're going to do is we're going to circle back after this is over and start over with 15 minutes for Mr. Smith. And so advise the clerk's office, Ms. Martins, when the situation is cured. We understand these things happen. As I said earlier, what we'll do is pretend that that Mr. Smith had not made such a hot argument that he'd set off the fire alarm. And we'll just instead just start as though we had not started before. Mr. Smith, you have 15 minutes. Please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. Mr. Lantis's sole claim is that the magistrate judge misapplied the criminal recklessness standard. This court traditionally presumes that a magistrate knows and correctly applies the law. However, it'll step in and find error when the record gives this court reason to think that such a presumption is misplaced. There's three points in the record that should give this court ample reason to think that the magistrate misapplied the criminal recklessness standard. The first portion is the magistrate's written conclusions of law, in which the court never once analyzes or determines whether Mr. Lantis subjectively believed that going off trail carried a risk and that he consciously disregarded that risk.
Well, wait, I'm going to interrupt you there, because isn't one of the ways we show subjective knowledge is by the obviousness of the risk?
In some cases, the obviousness of a risk can demonstrate, or a jury or a fact finder could infer from the obviousness of a risk that the defendant was subjectively aware. However, those are
finding that the magistrate judge made went beyond just recklessness. The magistrate judge said, while not necessary to support a guilty verdict, it would appear that the risks and dangers were so obvious that his conduct rises to knowingly creating the risk. I mean, I have a hard time saying that the judge did not make a finding on recklessness when the judge specifically said it was so obvious that I could have found knowingly.
Well, there's a lot to unpack in that statement. And my first answer would be that you could interpret that statement as saying that this risk was so obvious that Mr. Lantis subjectively was aware of the risk. The problem there is that's the criminal recklessness standard. And the court prefaces that statement by saying, while not necessary to a finding of guilt, he uses this rhetorical flourish at the end of his conclusion to say it could rise to the level of knowing. But it appears that the court's citing the correct recklessness standard and saying that it's not necessary for a finding of guilt. That should be conclusive proof that the court is misunderstanding the criminal recklessness standard.
I don't follow your argument that you just made. Can you walk me through it again?
Sure. Recklessness requires the subjective knowledge.
Would you agree recklessness is an easier intent obligation to meet than knowingly?
Yeah, and this is where it gets confusing in that the line between the two is incredibly thin. But what's important to understand is that the distinction between the two doesn't rest on the obviousness of a risk. The distinction is the how likely it is that the risk will occur. So for knowingly, the risk or the harm has to be practically certain to occur. For recklessness, you just have to have a substantial risk that the harm will occur.
If we're looking at how certain it was the risk would occur, the findings also say Mr. Lantis ensured he would be lost in the dark in an area of the park with a substantial blah 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 blah. I mean, it looks to me like the court is meeting that part of your argument too. He ensured it, and it was so obvious we could meet a knowingly standard.
Well, to take the portion of the court's statement in isolation, saying it's so obvious it rises to knowing, mm-hmm. that demonstrates that the court's misunderstanding the difference between reckless and knowing, because something doesn't become knowing by being more obvious. If the court had said these risks and dangers were so certain to occur that it was knowing, then yeah, that would make sense, and it would be proof that the court had correctly understood these standards.
Well, why does that matter? Why does that matter then? I mean, we know we don't need a knowing standard here. We need a reckless standard. And what you're saying is the court may have thought that the reckless standard was actually the knowing standard. So it found it was knowing, but at a minimum, it was very specific in finding that these risks and dangers were so obvious that his conduct rises to the knowing creation of the risk, which you're saying, okay, that means it rises to the reckless creation of the risk. So either way, the court made the findings it needs to make with respect to recklessness, didn't it?
No, that doesn't appear as part of its findings. It's a rhetorical flourish at the end of his findings that you've met the recklessness standard, and then says, while not necessary for a finding of guilt, it appears. Well, it doesn't have to appear. The government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this was so obvious that Mr. Lantis knew of it.
Let me interrupt again. You are now making an argument that the findings are inadequate. And this was a bench trial to a magistrate judge. And all the magistrate judge had to do, unless you made a motion for more, was to say guilty or not guilty. You had no right to any specific findings because you didn't make a motion under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure Rule 23. So now you want to fly spec the findings to say they're not quite detailed enough. And I just don't think you get to do that from a bench trial.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. We do not get to do that. What we're pointing to is that the findings that the court did make is record proof or evidence, sorry to use that word, but it's indicative or indicia that the magistrate is not correctly applying the test. You could picture the scenario where, you know, the court doesn't consider the subjective knowledge of Mr. Lantis and further says, you know, my finding of guilt is predicated solely on the objective reasonableness of the risk. I mean, there would be no issue that the court was misapplying the test that it cited if it went on to say, no, all I'm doing is focusing on the objectiveness. So that's why we look to the record, is to see whether or not the court is faithfully applying the test that it articulated at the beginning. And the second...
Well, would you agree with me if the court had said, I find you guilty in a one sentence order, that would be sufficient?
Absolutely sufficient. And I think that the cases in the guideline context help us in that they say a court has no obligation to make these findings. However, if they make these findings and it provides causes this court to think that it might be misapplying the standard, then it will be remanded, because this court's not going to turn a blind eye to a magistrate's sua sponte statements that demonstrate that it's not faithfully adhering to the criminal recklessness standard.
And what you're saying, it shows me that the court didn't faithfully apply the standard, is it didn't make a finding that said Mr. Lantis has extensive hiking experience and was well aware that going off trail in the middle of the backcountry of Yellowstone was highly likely to create a serious risk.
I don't think that's right, and that it's not a the fact that he didn't make that finding is not per se reversible error. Well, the argument is that he writes this detailed order. He doesn't make that finding, even though it's a key component of the case. And that's indicative of the fact that the court misunderstood what it actually was required to apply. If there's no reason to think that the court would write this order and leave out a key part, unless it was just misunderstood about what it actually had to find.
The real problem is the sufficiency of evidence thing, right? Because when you have to concede based on procedural history of the case that there was sufficient evidence, then that puts you in a position of having to say, sure, there was plenty of evidence there where the district court could have applied the correct legal standard, which it announced, but we don't like the way the wording of the magistrate's order is, and therefore, please reverse. That's a tough sell. I don't know that I've seen a case like that one.
Well, I think it's important to realize that there's a difference between sufficient evidence and harmless error standard. So you could think of a comparable case in the jury instruction. You don't have to bring a simultaneous sufficiency of the evidence claim to say the jury was properly instructed and this was harmful error. You can raise that error while conceding that the evidence was sufficient. And this court will still reverse and remand and say, no, you have the right for the jury to properly consider each element of this claim. And if we can find that error, that erroneous instruction was harmful, we'll remand for the jury to do that. And that's what we're asking for here, that the court did not faithfully apply that test. And Mr. Lantis's constitutional rights were violated by not requiring the government or holding the government to its burden of proof for each element. And so that does go into the harmful or the harmlessness inquiry of whether or not this court can say beyond a reasonable doubt that this error did not influence the outcome of this case. And I don't think that can be said, especially when it's considered that all the parties accept that at the time Mr. Lantis left the trail, he thought it was going to be an easier and a more downhill route. He thought he was taking a shortcut. And so if that's accepted as true.
Well, but it's not, because the district court didn't find that. The magistrate judge, we don't accept that as true. The magistrate judge obviously rejected that because he says, while the above may be considered reckless, any question in this regard is eliminated when Mr. Lantis left the marked trail, which would have returned him to the trailhead, and set off in the opposite direction was through some of the most remote and rugged country in Yellowstone. So whatever Mr. Lantis argued to the magistrate judge, it is implicit in the ruling that the magistrate judge did not buy that.
I don't think that can be. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
just push back in that I don't think it can be read as a functional rejection of Mr. Lantis's subjective beliefs, because in its finding of facts, it does reference Mr. Lantis's written statement and incorporates it into his finding of facts. The district court judge in its factual background says Mr. Lantis left the trail to avoid bears and thought the route was easier. The government in its own brief on appeal says that the route was harder than Mr. Lantis or more difficult than Mr. Lantis thought it was going to be. And everyone appears to accept, including the magistrate, that Mr. Lantis subjectively held this belief that this was a shortcut. And if he did, then as a matter of law, he can't be found guilty of criminal recklessness.
Is that true? This really comes down to at what point was he reckless? And taking one step off of the trail, he probably wasn't reckless. But once he got a mile in, I think he made it about 7 miles. Once he got a mile in and then he saw, oh my word, there's a boulder field and fallen logs and everything else. Maybe I should head back to the trail. At that moment, was it reckless? I can see at that moment where it might be reckless, subjectively.
Right. It would become reckless at the moment that he was subjectively aware of the risk, that he was going to need a helicopter rescue, and that his, and then he powers onwards, despite the fact that he knows that this is going to cause a helicopter rescue.
And the magistrate doesn't return to the trail. That's the recklessness, right?
Well, I'm not sure, because then there's a subjective calculation of, is it more, if I honestly think that it's only a mile to the road from the boulder field, but 10 miles back to the trail, I think you're trying to mitigate your risk at that point. And the evidence is that's what Mr. Lantis thought. And the court does indeed credit that within its finding of facts. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Ms. Martins.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. The United States is asking this court to affirm the conviction of Mr. Lantis and find that the district court correctly determined that the magistrate appropriately applied the criminal recklessness standard. And there are two main reasons for that. First, there's simply nothing wrong with the magistrate's findings of fact and conclusions of law. And second, properly limiting the case to the issues that's actually presented. If there is an error in the findings of fact, this court may simply correct it, applying its general appellate standards. And those standards allow this court to affirm Mr. Lantis's conviction for any basis apparent on the record. And when we look specifically at findings of fact under Rule 23, what this court has said is that any reviewing appellate court may simply infer any finding that is necessary to support the judgment. And that's true even in complex cases. I would agree with Mr. Lantis that where findings are not required, but then a court offers findings that demonstrate some sort of misapplication of the law or an error was committed, that the court shouldn't turn a blind eye. But the findings here demonstrate that the court appropriately applied the correct criminal recklessness standard, and there's just simply no problem with this order.
At what point along that hike or even stepping off the trail was subjective recklessness proved?
So there's a few avenues to prove that subjective recklessness. What Mr. Lantis points us to in this order, I think it's most clear when he steps off that trail late in the day near the top of Mount Holmes. And as the magistrate...
One step off the trail?
Probably not that first step, but once you get a few feet off of that trail and leave that trail with the idea you're going to hike through some of the most rugged country in Yellowstone, that I think is where we find real recklessness.
Isn't it when you realize that you can't return to the trail without a rescue?
I don't think that it requires you to get so far out that you can't get back. I think that leaving the marked trail out in that portion of Yellowstone all by itself, and I don't think you have to get a significant distance even off of that marked trail to realize the dangers of what's gone on here.
It's not recklessness to his own safety. It's recklessness to the rescuers, the public harm.
Yes.
So if he doesn't take a coat and he doesn't have 3 Butterfinger bars in his back pocket or whatever else, he may be reckless as far as he's concerned, but it's irrelevant for the criminal charge, isn't it? The only thing that matters is at what point did he risk substantial harm to rescuers? And that's not taking 5 feet off of the trail.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, that certainly just the ordinary circumstances, you have to get a ways off the trail before somebody's going to have to rescue you. Now, the testimony below didn't talk in great detail about exactly what the trail looked like when you step off of it. But the country up there is awfully rugged. There are places along marked trails where they follow rock faces. A foot off the trail in one portion could be including that risk of rescue, whereas a quarter mile off the trail in another location would engender that risk of rescue.
But now you're doing something that I fault the magistrate for, which is the passage that's been read here where the magistrate says that he then made a difficult and dangerous trek into an area not seen by rangers seldom, and talks about the ruggedness and the difficulty of the terrain. Well, that's great if you're an expert and you know all about what that terrain looks like, and maybe the magistrate does, or maybe a ranger told the magistrate that later, but it's what is in the defendant's head about what the defendant is going to be challenging as far as getting to the destination that matters, isn't it? We don't care if it's rugged and so forth, at least to the point where he kept going when he could have gone back.
Well, certainly. I don't necessarily disagree with the court's point, but I think what the record and necessarily the summary in the magistrate's order tells us is that those things were obvious, and that that obviousness supported his conscious understanding and disregard of that risk.
Well, he almost made it. He got within a couple of miles and the ranger was telling him, you've gotten through the hard part, you can make it, take a nap, I'll meet you at the trail. And had he made it to the trail, there wouldn't have been a criminal charge, right?
Probably not, but not because he didn't create that risk of...
How could there possibly be? No rescuers would be endangered.
And that's where we would have to make sure that he finishes that last 2 miles without falling and breaking his leg or having some other mishap along the way that would cause him to need that rescue. But if he had made it out, he wouldn't have put those public folks in danger. And then having only risked his own skin, that criminal citation would not have been appropriate. But that doesn't change the fact that his conduct was reckless all along. And recklessness doesn't hinge on his correct calculation of the risk or the fact that the risk ended up not coming to bear in a situation. His subjective understanding of that risk when he undertook the conduct, which was to leave the trail late in the day and head out into the backcountry, that's where we find the subjective understanding of the risks at play. And there's nothing wrong with the magistrate summarizing the objective facts before it to conclude that Mr. Lantis subjectively understood that there was a risk.
Unfortunately, that's not really what the magistrate did, though. It didn't really ever come to that conclusion that that's what it was relying on, were these objective factors for its subjective determination. We don't really know that, do we?
Well, I think when you look at the court's order, and what we find is that that's functionally what that's doing. So pages 31 and 32, volume 1 of the record, is where you'll find the magistrate laying out the correct legal standard for recklessness and then summarizing the facts before it in testimony. Mm-hmm. And what we look there at is that those facts in testimony are related to the objective testimony provided at the bench trial. And that's simply what the government must rely on in pretty much every criminal case, is a look at the objective observable circumstances in the world from which we infer a defendant's subjective intent, whether it's premeditation for homicide or recklessness for this disorderly conduct citation. And when we look at what has been said about recklessness, here the magistrate court relied on the model penal code and a couple of cases. Specifically, the parties have also relied on cases like Boisin and Farmer, where the United States Supreme Court summarizes that common law notion of recklessness. And even the United States Supreme Court in Farmer says that fact finders are entitled to rely on the obviousness of the risk in order to find that subjective component of recklessness. And that's simply
that,
what
the, is it enough here that the district court made that remark that the conduct, the dangers were so obvious that it was knowing, I guess is what the court said, but that the dangers were so obvious. Is that enough to kind of pull it all together? You throw all this out there and then you say, yep, it was so obvious that it was reckless? Or does there still have to be some tying of this defendant's experience? Or was he an experienced hiker? Was he a completely inexperienced hiker? How should he have known all these things? Or is it just obvious to anyone? Does that make sense?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe I understand. So first I would say yes. The fact that the magistrate court said that it was so obvious it was practically knowing, that's enough to tie it together for the purpose of the findings of fact. But secondly, there's even more in the record beyond the summary in the court's order to support its conclusion. And that's where we have Mr. Lantis undertaking specific actions that are only useful in terms of mitigating the risks of which he was aware. So the fact that he took items with him in the first place demonstrates that he understood that there is inherent risk on just being on the trail. And so we have things like a cell phone, radio, GPS, all of those things are only useful in case of communicating for emergencies, letting people know where you are. And so just being on the trail, he took those steps.
That seems the opposite of reckless. He is ensuring that he's not going to have to be rescued with those devices.
But when we're talking about whether he understood the dangers of being out in the wilderness, there's two questions here. One, whether it was reckless to leave the trail, and his understanding of the world around him. So when we're talking about it in terms of his understanding of the world around him, his actions geared toward risk mitigation certainly showed the understanding of the world around him. And furthermore, he called to tell people where he was going and what he was doing when he left the trail, yet again, underscoring his understanding of the world around him. There was no evidence in the record that Mr. Lantis was any less capable than any average person of understanding the risks around him. And in the absence of his testimony, when we look at that written statement that he gave the ranger, where he says he thought that he identified bear, scat, and fur on the trail, that even implies special knowledge of the wilderness. So when we're thinking about what's obvious to him and what's available in the record to support the magistrate's conclusion beyond its summary, which this court can look to affirm, there's certainly evidence that he subjectively understood the risks and maybe even had some special knowledge of the wilderness and its dangers. Now, the magistrate specifically points to him leaving the trail late in the day, virtually ensuring that he would be trying to traverse this difficult terrain that he understood was inherently risky just being on the trail in the dark.
Why does that matter? He spent the night in the wilderness, true, but that doesn't support a charge. No helicopter came.
Well, that keeps coming up, but all he has to do is create public alarm, right?
True.
So there doesn't have to be a helicopter rescue to violate this statute, does there?
I don't know that there necessarily does. I think that we...
if you have the rangers are all on notice that you got this guy out there and they're monitoring it and they have public alarm.
Yes.
I mean, is that a violation of this statute?
Certainly. And I think that when we talk about public alarm, the levels of alarm and whether it makes sense to, as a practical matter, pursue the citation, I don't know that the citation would have necessarily been pursued, but for the rescue and the extra dangers that it created as a practical matter, but as a legal matter.
Well, it's really the restitution, isn't it? I mean, isn't this case really about restitution? They incurred costs from a private helicopter service to rescue Mr. Lantis, and this is all about trying to recoup those expenses. Realistically.
I think
he walked out like Judge Phillips suggested, you know, he made it that extra 2.3 miles and got on the paved trail, the, you know, designated trail. There might have been public alarm. Everybody might have been worried about him. Mm-hmm. but they wouldn't have expended any cash bringing in a helicopter. So it seems to me that's really what the focus is here, right?
I think as a practical matter, that's probably so, especially considering that Mr. Lantis spent no time in jail, paid no actual fine, was only sentenced to unsupervised probation and restitution. So
but he also, wasn't he banned from the park for 5 years also?
Yes. As part of his unsupervised probation, he was in fact banned from the park, which the magistrate caveated at sentencing that once the Forest Fen treasure was found, that Mr. Lantis could come back with a motion to remove that provision because that treasure hunt was supposedly his motivation for his adventures through the wilderness. But all of that said, the stakes in this case seem to be wrapped around that restitution order because it seems like the biggest thing.
Well, then is Judge Phillips correct that the time that we really ought to be looking at is when he recklessly created a situation that required a helicopter rescue?
I think that the magistrate focused on the decision to leave the trail, and there's no specific time in there that has to be proven because it's one of those on or about on this day kind of charges. So anywhere in there will work. And then when we look at that calculation of risk, I would go back to the idea that recklessness doesn't require Mr. Lantis to be right about that risk. Because remember, recklessness defined in opposition to intentional, purposeful, and knowing. Intentional is the conscious object. Knowing is practical certainty. You can have recklessness in relatively low probability situations. And for that, I would turn the court to Lefebvre on the substantive criminal law relied on by the U.S. Supreme Court and Farmer for those propositions and that explanation.
Well, let me ask you this. This is a weird hypothetical. So I'm hiking in Yellowstone and I feel the call of nature and I go off trail to find a secluded place to answer that call, at which point I'm attacked by a bear. Have I violated the statute?
I think it would depend on whether there's any evidence you knew there were bears in the area and the area.
Of course I know there's bears. Of course I know there's bears in the area. I'm in Yellowstone. So that's it. All I have to know is that I'm on a trail in Yellowstone. Yellowstone has a lot of bears. And any time I go off the trail, I've violated the statute.
No, I don't think it goes that far, Your Honor. I think it would depend a little more on the specific circumstances and what the government could prove about what you knew and how you went off the trail.
What if it really were a shortcut? And there were just a few logs and a few boulders, but he sprained his ankle and he would have been up the trail sooner, but now he needs a rescue. Violate regulation?
I would think so, Your Honor. If he's off the trail, bushwhacking through that part, even if it is a shortcut, it might have actually been shorter as a straight line than the trail, but that doesn't change the dangerousness of the conduct.
Okay. Any other questions? Mr. Smith has some time left, I believe, and we'll give him a little extra since we took Ms. Martin's over.
Just want to briefly touch on the concept of reading this record as a sub silentio adoption of this theory that the risk was so obvious. The first being that this is not the type of risk that's subject to that sort of analysis. The understanding of this risk only comes with specialized knowledge. If you told a general member of the community, would you take a 4-mile trail path back to your car or 2 miles off trail? They're not going to know how hard it is to hike off trail and that's the wrong choice to make, that you want to stay on the trail. The second problem is that, as Farmer V. Brennan makes clear, that the obviousness of a risk cannot be conclusive. So in this case, when there is evidence that they subjectively believed that Mr. Lantis subjectively believed this was the less riskier option, it can only be rejected by the fact finder if the acts and conduct of the defendant make such a belief improbable. And it's hard to believe that the magistrate was fully understanding this complete test and making an uncredibility finding against Mr. Lantis without saying anything. So For those reasons, we'd ask this court to vacate the judgment and remand for further proceedings.
Thank you both for your arguments. The case is submitted.